I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gail Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, the IPCC, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, issued a report that paints a gloomy global picture. Even if we're able to limit global warming and temperatures from rising more than 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a big if, we could see serious changes to weather, sea levels, agriculture, and natural ecosystems. The analysis in the report comes as little shock to people who've been shouting about the dangers of a warming Earth for a decade or more now. But it serves as a shoulder shake for those who've become complacent, and it centralizes the message of what we're likely to experience. President Donald Trump says scientists have an agenda. They have a political bias. And that may be true insofar as scientists want to see policies that help prevent some of the most dire consequences of a changing climate. But in order for the world to curb the rising temperatures and rising seas, the world will have to act, and that will cross borders, political parties, social and economic classes, languages, and generations. So how does Vermont fit in? What are individuals doing in their own lives, but also to spur bigger action? We're going to spend the hour looking at what the report says and how we apply it to Vermont, policy, personal behavior, activism, and preparation. And joining us for the hour is Bill McKibben, author, educator, environmentalist, and one of the founders of 350.org. That's a grassroots global organization now dedicated to curbing climate change. He joins us from the Middlebury College studio. Bill, it's nice to talk with you again.
Hey, as always, Jane, and I'm a completely gorgeous Vermont day.
It is a gorgeous Vermont day, and you look out and think, what a wonderful and beautiful place we live in, and then you read the IPCC report and think, is this the world we're going to have in 20 or 30 years or 50 years? What was your reaction to the report?
Well, look, I mean, I wrote the first book about climate change 30 years ago next year, a book called The End of Nature, and really nothing that's happening now is a surprise, except that it's coming faster than we expected. Scientists, by their nature, are conservative and so have underestimated consistently how big and how fast the impacts from climate change were going to be. If you want to just think about the math of it for a minute, Jane, here's how I'd lay it out. So far, we've increased the temperature of the planet 1 degree Celsius, about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit. That doesn't sound like much, but it's been enough to melt most of the sea ice in the Arctic. It's got the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets melting rapidly. It's killed off huge swaths of the world's coral reefs. It's rejiggered weather patterns so that we now have both far more intense drought and far more intense flood just because warm air holds more water vapor than cold. You know what it's done to redesign the seasons even in a place like Vermont, and where winter is considerably shorter on average than it used to be and warmer. We can tell that by looking at things like the spread of ticks carrying Lyme disease up through the North Country. That's at 1 degree Celsius. The report that came out this week is an analysis of what it would take to hold the temperature increases to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And what it would take is, as they put in the report, unprecedented action on a global scale. Because we've waited so long to really do much of anything about climate change, the change that we now would need to make would be enormous if we were going to meet that 1.5 degree target or even the 2 degrees Celsius target that's been the kind of red line that the global community has set for many years. If we'd all kept the promises that we made coming out of the Paris Climate Accords in 2015, if every country had done what it promised to do, the temperature would still have gone up about 3.5 degrees Celsius. That's the trajectory that we're on. And of course, every country is not keeping the promises that it made. Many of them are slipping, and the United States, shamefully, has become the first nation on Earth to withdraw entirely from those accords. So the picture is, I must say, not very bright. We haven't so far as a state, as a country, as a civilization, as a planet, begun to respond with anything like the vigor that science demands. And I think the biggest bottom line message from the IPCC report is if you're going to do anything, you damn well better do it fast because, you know, past a certain point, I mean, this is the first problem we've faced with a time limit. And once we go past certain tipping points, there's no getting them back.
Although, interestingly, the IPCC report also talked about what might happen if we go past that and then try to pull back. You know, how can we race past that that moment but then come back and what impacts would there be? No more coral reefs, but could we get some of the polar ice cap back? Could we somehow, you know, have an Earth that goes a little warmer and then cools down a little bit? You know, there's a ton of stuff to talk about, so I want to bring another voice into the conversation. And perhaps it shouldn't be surprising because this is a topic that really is on the minds of many, but we have been getting a ton of listener response before the show. So I really want to take a back seat to some of the questions and concerns that our listeners are raising. And I'll read one right here. David emailed in to say, as an internal medicine physician, I recognize that climate change is the greatest threat to public health we have ever faced. I'm worried for my patients and also for our children. Many people, including some of our legislative leaders, continue to argue that climate change is not real or not man-made, preventing us from implementing meaningful policy change in Vermont. How do we help them understand the reality and gravity of the situation? Dick says, I challenge the guests on the show today to talk about the hard issues here, the need for us as a culture to change our lifestyles, to use considerably less energy than we do today, not just make everything in our lives run on electricity and think the problem is solved. We need real solutions to the climate crisis now. The real solutions won't be easy or necessarily profitable, but it is our obligation to future generations to figure it out, and time is short. And Pete in Starksboro says, I'm wondering if your guests could tackle the issue of personal choices and how they impact climate and discuss the role of conservation and low energy lifestyles in addressing the climate crisis. And to that point, I'd love to hear about their recommendations for lifestyle changes that are low or no cost and therefore accessible to all Vermonters despite their level of income. So to start talking about some of those issues, let's bring in another voice here. Johanna Miller is Energy and Climate Action Program Director at the Vermont Natural Resources Council. She coordinates the statewide network of town energy committees, well over 100 now, and was one of the 21 members of the Governor's Climate Action Committee. It's nice to talk with you today, Johanna.
It's good to be here, Jane. Thank you.
So what are local communities, town action committees, town energy committees doing on this issue?
Well, they're doing a lot. The leadership at the local level is strong and inspiring, and it has been for a while. They're getting solar installed on their schools. They're retrofitting municipal buildings. They're, you know, tackling transportation, our largest greenhouse gas emission sector here in the state of Vermont. They're doing broad educational events. They're doing a lot, and they're doing it all as volunteers, which is commendable, but not sufficient in terms of what is going to be required to tackle the urgent challenge that we've been highlighting here in this important show. So, and I also would say it's really important to underscore that what these communities are able to do is helped or hindered by strong public policy and political leadership. As one of the comments you just read underscores, you know, Vermonters overwhelmingly care about climate change. They want to see, you know, and help Vermonters participate in the clean energy transition. But that's going to require real leadership at the legislative level and at the local level. And it is inspiring what's happening at the local level, but it's not enough. We don't have policy or political framework to do as much as we need to do as quickly as we need to do it.
So, Johanna, how do you feel like community action groups fit in then? I mean, is this sort of a feel-good exercise, or does it spur more community action groups, which spur a groundswell of action, which then compel governments, larger government structures to act, or what?
Well, they play a powerful role. I mean, they're trusted, you know, unbiased, impartial, you know, volunteers who care about the fate of their communities and care about their friends and neighbors. But, you know, the work that I've been doing at the local level, I've been doing for, you know, over a decade now, and we've made, you know, strong progress, but, you know, very limited progress as well. So something needs to change, and it needs to be dramatic, and it needs to be swift. And the good news is that there's opportunity in that transition, considering the fact that we import 100% of the fossil fuels that we use here in the state of Vermont, which means that we are tethered to a volatile international oil market. And that also means that we don't have control over our own fate. So reducing our use of imported dirty fossil fuels is a money-saving issue. It keeps more dollars in the state, putting Vermonters to work, weatherizing homes, getting solar installed on schools, installing heat pumps and advanced wood heating systems, keeping dollars in the state of Vermont instead of sending them elsewhere, which is not always also part, you know, it is not also a climate issue, but it is an economic issue. So these groups are doing a lot, but it is, you know, it is not enough. We need to get serious about this issue, and we need to lead as a state, considering, as you noted earlier, Jane, that the Trump administration and many in the Republican Party, unfortunately, it's not a partisan issue, but many Republicans have abdicated, science and facts, and it really is incumbent on states and communities to lead. And here in Vermont, we're well positioned to do that and implement issues, you know, all of the above solutions, as many of your callers have indicated. We need conservation. We need efficiency. We need lifestyle changes. We need, you know, more solar, more wind, more transportation efficiency solutions, more of everything, and we need it now. And that will require a strong policy framework and strong political will to actually accomplish it.
Dan in Burlington emailed in to say last year, Paul Hawken and the Project Drawdown team released the results of their comprehensive analysis of ideas for addressing climate change. Seems like we should copy this model and create a Project Drawdown for Vermont that focuses on lowering the two highest areas of carbon pollution here, transportation and buildings. As it stands today, we're unrealistically expecting our legislators, who have no staff, to do all this work. Between the Gund Institute, the Rubenstein School, the Vermont Law School, various clean energy NGOs and consultants, and the many clean energy entrepreneurs in the state, we have the people. Is it unrealistic to think or hope that we can bring these pieces together and come up with a set of innovative policy initiatives that will create good jobs in the new energy economy while helping to protect the health and well-being of our kids and our communities? And let's get a voice in here from John in Stratford. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Go right ahead. What are you thinking?
Hello. Well, here's one thing that we can all do immediately is we can do carbon offsets for our own personal use. There's a number of organizations, including some in Vermont, that provide calculators and the ability for us to do our own carbon offsets and put those funds towards projects either here in Vermont or elsewhere in the world that actually do something. And this doesn't require any government or political action. It requires us to be personally responsible for the carbon that we use. And I think it's something we should all immediately consider doing.
John, thanks for your call. Bill McKibben, what are you thinking, hearing all of these thoughts on our local actions, but also the need for greater action, bigger action, more comprehensive action?
Well, I think that everybody's points are well taken, and there's no reason that people shouldn't be doing carbon offsets, shouldn't be figuring out how to make their own homes more efficient and conserve energy. However, I think it's really worth remembering just the fact that this is an urgent crisis with a time limit. And so probably the most important thing individuals can do is become somewhat less of an individual, join together with other people in the kind of movements that push big policy changes, not just here but around the world. Because, of course, even if we manage to get Vermont in perfect shape, which so far we're not doing, Vermont's not blazing a trail particularly, but even if we do, that won't solve the problem. We have to look for moments of massive leverage. And if we look around the state of Vermont for what those are, I mean, let me give you an example. People have come together in movements like 350VT to push the state to divest its pension funds from fossil fuels. If the state did that, it would be joining what's now a very rapidly growing movement around the world. We just passed the $7 trillion mark for endowments and portfolios that have done this. The city of New York just divested its 200 and some billion dollar pension fund. The nation of Ireland did the same. These have put huge pressure on the fossil fuel companies. Shell just announced that divestment had become a material risk to its future. If we're able to keep up that pressure, then we may be able to get systemic change. So I guess what I'd say to people is, you know, my house is covered with solar panels. I drove one of the first electric Fords in the state of Vermont. I'm completely for good, strong local action. Everything that Joey Miller and VNRC is doing is exactly right. But I don't try to fool myself that those solar panels on my roof are the way that we're going to solve climate change. At this late date, it's also going to take really strenuous political action and political confrontation with the forces, especially the fossil fuel industry, that are the ones who have kept us locked in this paralysis for a generation now, even as we face the greatest threat we've ever faced.
We got a note from Steve who says, basically, if we were concerned about climate change, we'd stop selling new cars, close all tourist destinations, stop motorsports and professional sports, eliminate recreational air travel, stop making plastic stuff. We cannot maintain our current excessive lifestyle and expect to meet climate goals. What we are doing is driving to the mall in our big SUV and thinking we will save the world by reusing reusable shopping bags. So, Johanna, you know, humans are notoriously bad at doing anything that is short-term pain, even for a payout in the end. You know, whether it's weight loss, whether it's saving money or saving the earth. If everything looks fine now and it costs us less and we get to do what we want, we are less likely to do the right thing because it's not the easy thing in the short term. So do you have any hope that we're going to look at this 2040 date, which is so much closer than many people were thinking, or any other date in the future, and actually do the really hard things that are going to be required of us to stop a rising temperature?
Well, Jane, I have to. I think everyone does. You have to look yourself in the mirror and say, we have to do everything. We have to do dramatic lifestyle changes. Unfortunately, I don't think what your caller said is going to be feasible. But we do need to do the small things, but we need to do, you know, the far bigger things, as Bill said as well. We need solutions commensurate with the challenge that we face, and it is huge. But as I said before, for Vermont and for the world, it is perhaps the biggest economic development opportunity we have ever seen. And we have the technology at our fingertips to do it now, do it well, do it right. We need big, overarching, you know, movement building, powerful, like, responses like divestment. We also need things like pollution pricing. You know, I've been working on this with a coalition of low-income and business advocates and academics and environmental groups for several years to look at how do we actually, you know, pull the lever in our currently unregulated liquid fuel sector. So right now, our two largest sectors for greenhouse gas emissions are transportation and home heating, thermal. And we don't have very many levers to pull to require, you know, all of us to make small first and then larger changes in lifestyle, in investments, and in energy solutions. So I think we should be looking closely at economy-wide policies like carbon pricing or cap and invest, which is happening in an impartial economic analysis underway right now at the Joint Fiscal Office. But I hope we take the results of that study seriously. And one of the examples that they're looking into in this study is the Western Climate Initiative, which has been in place in Quebec, our neighbors to the north, which is a cap and invest program where they are actually putting a price on carbon pollution using the dollars raised to invest in themselves invest in the 21st century clean energy solutions that are doing something about climate, but actually saving them money. And the Quebec example is powerful because it's a really pretty picture. Their GDP is rising and their greenhouse gas emissions are being lowered. So that's what we need to do. We must be open to the kinds of solutions that are going to meet the challenge that we face, and also, wean us off of dirty, imported fossil fuels in a way that works for everyone. Of course, protecting the most vulnerable among us is critical. Right now, low-income Vermonters spend far more of their incomes on energy than higher-income Vermonters. We need solutions that alleviate the burden on those who can't afford to pay more. But it's going to be a process. We need a transition. And the long and the short of it is, this has happened before. I don't know if your callers probably, or your listeners probably remember back in the late 2000s when the price of gasoline and heating oil went up significantly. I was working with local energy committees at that time, and I can tell you right now that people changed their behavior rapidly. And though we were paying about $4 a gallon, with none of those additional dollars staying in state, as opposed to a well-structured price on carbon, people made different decisions. They carpooled more. They vanpooled. They telecommuted. They walked to work. And it was challenging. But ultimately, we're talking about a transition, a needed, essential transition because of the crisis of climate, but also because of the fact that this is an economic opportunity in getting off of dirty imported fossil fuels in Vermont.
That's Johanna Miller, Energy and Climate Action Program Director at the Vermont Natural Resources Council, and she coordinates the statewide network of town energy committees. Johanna, thanks very much for talking with us. Appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity. I look forward to following up and having more conversations about this important issue. Thank you, Jane.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with 350.org co-founder Bill McKibben and others in our region about climate change and what to do about it. This is sort of a broad strokes look, and we're talking about a lot of different angles on this issue. So it's sort of a popcorn approach to addressing this question. And then, we will be able to have deeper conversations about some of these in the future. But just to give you a sense of what people are thinking and saying in our region, Ian from Richmond says, I hear a lot of conversation about how Vermont needs to keep and attract more young people. As a recent graduate from a Vermont college, I can say I have chosen to stay in Vermont because of the opportunities to take action on climate change. How can and should ordinary Vermonters hold their public leaders, including the governor, accountable to help solve the climate crisis? Keegan says, as someone who wishes to buy land and follow permaculture concepts of building and growing, but find that there are already too many governmental restrictions forbidding it, shouldn't we look toward ways that allow individuals the freedom to take climate change into their own hands? The government restrictions I'm speaking of are building codes that don't allow eco-friendly building concepts like COB, and mandate materials that are in compliance with fire codes that have a great deal of chemicals in them. Furthermore, we don't allow composting toilets in many areas of the country. Ray in VT says there are a lot of things that we can do at the personal, local, and state level, and we should push on the fronts that we can as vigorously as possible. We are, though, only a small state with a small population, and we need broader action nationally and internationally. At present, national action is unlikely, given that the administration is giving preference to fossil fuels, trying to weaken environmental and efficiency rules, and that the president has a history of saying that climate change is a hoax or alluding to scientists being somehow biased in their research. But then finally, Chris says climate change has been used as an excuse to give taxpayer money to the wealthy in the form of subsidies for solar panels and electric cars, which the average person cannot afford. The people who are pushing for a carbon tax only want lower electricity rates so they can continue living their extravagant and unsustainable lifestyles. Wake up, folks, Chris writes. These programs are doing nothing to stop the pollution and plastic waste that's destroying the earth. But in terms of carbon tax, Greg in Cornwall says, what are the advantages and any disadvantages to pricing carbon? And could Vermont do that without hurting low-income people, maybe through a rebate program or lower electricity bills? Well, let's bring in a voice here who can talk a little bit about the state approach along with Bill McKibben. Peter Walk is Deputy Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources and co-chair of the Governor's Climate Action Committee. Peter, it's nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Jane. I look forward to the discussion.
Well, so what about what people are saying about how Vermont fits in here, both in our policies as a state and how that affects people here, but then where we fit into that bigger national or international picture? I know that's, you know, like an hour-long answer, but what are your sort of succinct thoughts on that?
I'll do my best to answer that question. I think you're hearing the structure of the debate in some ways, right? It's not about whether or not we agree that the climate is changing and that we need to act. It's the what do those actions look like? In many instances, I understand what Joanna was talking about. She was a member of the Climate Commission, that we need actions that are commensurate with the challenge. But ultimately, the changes, the individual changes that happen, are all at the personal and community level, right? When we think about, you know, think about your daily existence, and we need to, you know, if as I'm making decisions about how I heat my home and how I drive, how I get to work, whether that be public transportation or walking or driving my own vehicle, what does my vehicle look like? Have I taken all the steps I need to do to weatherize my home so that I can save money on my fuel while also decreasing my emissions? Am I just choosing to use a renewable fuel such as pellets or some other form of fuel? Am I using, taking advantage of our relatively clean electric grid to use a cold climate heat pump? These are all choices that we all need to make, and they're daunting for people. It's not a question of whether or not most of these things can save people money at this point. That piece is proven out. It's where do I start and how do I get there?
But don't larger policies, whether they're state policies, national or international policies, have a huge influence on our individual actions in terms of what's affordable, what's available, you know, what we can get money for up front when we don't necessarily have that money to invest in something that will save us money down the line? I mean, aren't our policies really influential in our individual actions?
Absolutely. And that's why a lot of those things exist. That's why we have the federal level, there's a tax credit for electric vehicles. That's why we've worked on, through the Clean Energy Development Fund in Vermont and through other ways, trying to get pellet boilers in people's homes, and why people are using the Tier 3 of the Renewable Energy Standard that was passed through the legislature to provide incentives for electric vehicles and incentives for cold climate heat pumps. Those are public policies that are out there and working. But it's not just about cost. It's about knowing what to do and how to do it. And in some place, it's still about cost for lots of people. It's still about, I can do, this is how much extra I can afford on something. And if that might be the financing that ultimately saves me money, but if I can't afford the payment on that, even with a grant that buys down the overall cost of the loan, it becomes inaccessible to people. So I am of the mindset that we have to tackle all of these policies, big and small, and we have to tackle all of the and make it as user friendly for people as we can. And part of that is how we communicate with people. Many of the issues that we have in Vermont and around the world around asthma and COPD and other sort of respiratory illnesses, one of the primary ways that doctors are now looking at this is by saying, how do we think of this as a health problem? This is a health problem that we need to solve. And the solution, in many cases, is better indoor air quality. And that comes through weatherization and other activities that have knock-on benefits. So we're seeing activities that are taking place that aren't couched as a climate change activity, but are having those knock-on benefits because there is a multiplicity of benefits for everything that we're doing in this front. But it's pulling all these strings together to create the solution that becomes much harder to discuss.
Let's dip back into our calls here and see what listeners are thinking and wondering and feeling on this. Jack's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Jane. In VPR's Lieutenant Governor's debate last week, I heard the Republican candidate, Don Turner, say that Vermont, you know, has reduced its carbon footprint. And I know that's not true. I'm sure Peter Walk knows that's not true. And it's emblematic of a larger problem. You know, how do we solve an existential crisis like climate change when one of the major political parties in this country continues to insist that the science isn't real or that it's not a problem, or in the case of Don Turner, is out there, you know, spreading misinformation?
Jack, I take your point, and I'm going to toss this to Bill McKibben. But before I do, let's get another question or thought in here from Isabel in Burlington. Hi, Isabel. What's your perspective?
Hi. Yeah. So it's really concerning to me that some of our elected leaders really haven't taken the climate crisis seriously. And what really confuses me is that Governor Scott was willing to flip his vote on something like gun control, saying that he wanted to protect children, but has not been willing to do the same about issues of climate action. So my question is, what will it take for Governor Scott to listen to the thousands of Vermont youth, which he claims that he wants to protect, that are calling for their government to make bold climate action and protect the planet?
Isabel, thanks for your thoughts. Bill McKibben, what about our political leaders and political parties and making climate change a partisan issue?
Well, look, I mean, we suffer. I mean, all this discussion is hard at the moment because the country is run by an unstable man who clearly knows nothing about nothing and is proud to shout about it all day long. And so it makes everything hard to discuss. It's not as if we were making unbelievable progress on climate change before Donald Trump, however. And it's not as if there isn't a bipartisan problem with delay. For instance, we were talking before about divestment in Vermont. The state official who could do the most quickly and easily to deal with this problem and save pensioners a huge amount of money in the course of doing it is the Democratic state treasurer, Beth Pearce. But she never has, despite endless entreaty from – so I think that it's completely true that the Republican Party, at least on a national level, has been a wholly owned subsidiary of the fossil fuel industry and of the Koch brothers, and that has kept progress from happening for a long time. And it's also true that given the speed with which we now need to move, there's no excuse for any politician not to be we don't need people saying we believe that climate change is real or we think some action should be – I mean we have to actually do a lot of stuff now. One of the things that I have to keep myself from doing since I started writing about this 30 years ago is saying, you know, oh, if only you'd listened to me then. 30 years ago, we had relatively gentle pathways out of this problem. But we've lost that 30 years. We've lost a generation. And so now we have to move more uncomfortably than we want to. And if I were running Vermont, you know, one of the first things I'd do is take the Efficiency Vermont, which has done an amazing job of efficiency in electricity around Vermont, and let it have its full swath of powers applied to home heating and to transportation. The same kind of things that have allowed people to install new motors in factories and so on and so forth would do a wealth of good in those places. Those are the kind of things that if we did them, would begin to address this problem. Just the point is, as we do them fast. Do not do them the easy way. Do not do – if I have a problem with the Scott administration, it's just that it is calm, you know, about all these things and taking its time and not wanting to rattle anybody. We need to be rattled. That's what this IPCC report should do. If the world scientists say, look, you've got 15 years at best to end the burning of fossil fuel, well, that's a challenge. Now rise to it.
We're talking today about global warming. We're talking about the IPCC report. We're looking at this sort of lots of issues that are coming out of this, what Vermont can do, what individuals can do. I know we could certainly talk more about state policies. And Peter Walk, we barely got started with you on that. And so we'll have to do more on that in the future. Peter Walk is Deputy Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources and co-chair of the Governor's Climate Action Commission. Thanks for talking with us today, Peter.
I appreciate it. I'm going to be still listening because this is a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Good. Well, we're still listening too. We're listening to what you are sending us and by ways of emails and comments online and calls. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today, we're focusing the hour on climate change and where we fit in as individuals and as a state or region. We're looking at some of the many, many issues and questions that come up when you get a report like the IPCC's report about some dire consequences as soon as 2040 if we don't make massive changes to our lifestyles, our policies, on a global scale. Seems unlikely, but what would it take? We're talking about that, and we're also talking about areas where people are taking action and what those approaches are. We've been talking about state policy, community action, and more with Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, as well as other voices. And now we'll add Joshua Faulkner to the mix. He's program coordinator of the Farming and Climate Change Program at UVM Extension. Joshua, nice to talk with you today.
Good to be with you, Jane.
Let me read you some of the questions that have been coming in and thoughts that have been coming in on soil health, on food policy. Marilyn in Brattleboro says, 2 years ago, I was inspired to learn more about soil and its relation to climate change. Within a few months, I attended two soil seminars, which totally shifted my perspective on climate change. Becoming aware of the power of balancing the carbon and water cycles through building the soil carbon sponge has given me hope and a realization that it is possible to cool the planet before it's too late. It is hope that's lacking in the dire predictions of the IPCC. And Beth in St. Johnsbury says, our climate problem isn't all up in the air, it's underfoot. The ground of our being is healthy soil. Without it, we have, all over this earth, deranged water, energy, and carbon cycles. It's a low-tech planet running on solar energy, air, and water. And with as many organisms and microorganisms in a spoon of healthy, carbon-rich soil as there are people living today. Just as our atmosphere, as thin a layer over the planet as the skin on an apple, protects us from the cold of outer space, so our soil, a similarly thin layer, is all that allows us to eat and drink. By taking care of the land, we can cool the soil and ourselves. By letting plants, animals, and trees return carbon from the air to the soil, we can begin to restore the water cycle. Managed grazing allows animals to speed the return of carbon to the soil, allowing soil to absorb, filter, and hold water. This prevents runoff and provides water to roots in times of drought. So, Joshua, what are you doing in terms of working with people who work on the land to think about how we can affect the landscape and our relationship to climate change?
Sure. I have to first say it's really exciting to hear the comments that you just read, because soils, I think, are a really important piece of this. And agriculture does offer a little bit of hope moving forward. And I think we need to start to kind of understand this. You spoke about, the comments were about adaptation and mitigation, but we really need to start with an understanding of where greenhouse gas emissions come from in agriculture. And we think about diesel fuel and electricity, but that's really a small piece of the picture. And about 40% of our emissions from agriculture actually come from the soil. So this is our largest source, and this is our largest opportunity to help reduce those emissions and capture some greenhouse gases. And I think Vermont, you know, with the work that's happened and is continuing to happen with water quality, we're making great strides in helping to harness the power of soils for capturing carbon and reducing nitrous oxide emissions, which are 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. You know, some of the no-till practices, some of the cover cropping practices, the conservation measures that farmers are using and UVM Extension is promoting, I think put us in a really good position to continue forward with transitioning from not just helping the lake, but also mitigating climate change.
Let's go to Grace, who's calling in from Barnett. Hi, Grace. You have thoughts on the soil as well?
Yeah, I do. And I think Josh just reiterated what I was going to say. And along with the comments from Beth and Marilyn, we're all on the same page on that level. And I think the point here is that soil management is readily doable now. We can change practices. It's not going to cost us hardly anything, and in fact, many farms will see an increase in profitability because of improved fertility, improved water retention and drainage, as well as the bonus of water quality improvement, and some would claim better food. So I really thank Josh for the work he's doing, and we've got to proliferated, you know.
Yeah, Grace, I hear what you're saying. And another comment coming in from Fran in Weybridge, who says, some of our conventional dairy farmers are claiming that they can sequester carbon and are the key to reversing climate change. Is there any truth to this claim? Joshua?
I think there is some truth. I think we need to keep it in perspective. But certainly dairy farmers are the farmers in Vermont that manage the most land. So those are the farmers who have the most opportunity to capture carbon and have an impact in this effort to mitigate climate change. There are a lot of research kinks yet to be worked out, but we do know that we can capture carbon in our soils, and we certainly know that we can reduce the nitrous oxide emissions through improved management of our nutrients, of our manure additions to the soil. So I think there is some truth there.
Bill McKibben, we started off the show by you saying what a beautiful fall day it is here in Vermont. And of course, so much of that is based on our landscape and how we view our relationship to the land. So when you look at the agricultural picture and how that fits in, what do you think?
Well, look, there's no question that since we've got too much carbon in the air, we're going to have to figure out how to get some of it out. And one of the ways to do that is with changed agricultural practices. You can put carbon back into the soil instead of mining it, which is largely what we've been doing. The problem, of course, is that we have a short time and there are a couple of billion farmers on Earth. So organizing them effectively and getting that change to scale to a point where it matters is a difficult task. It's one of the reasons that people have concentrated on where about 80% of emissions are coming from the fossil fuel industry. They're immensely politically powerful, but there's only 70 or 80 players. So there's probably more chance of getting rapid action. That doesn't mean that over the long run we shouldn't be doing exactly what Josh and UVM and farmers around Vermont have begun to experiment with. And we need to figure out how to make that happen on as large a scale as possible. Just I think this goes for all the solutions people are talking about. They're all good, and one by one, they don't get the job done. We have to do not only those things that are comfortable for us and relatively straightforward, but things that are uncomfortable, which for Americans in this day and age usually means engaging in the kind of political action that really shifts the debate. If we can't shift the zeitgeist quickly so that people no longer put up with long delay, a long kind of paralysis, then we're not going to get where we need to go. And in that case, really in any case, I think the best one piece of advice is enjoy beautiful days like today. Take full advantage of every winter snowstorm that we still get. Part of our job is to witness just what a beautiful place we've been given. And if we're doing that, then maybe it'll move us to the scale of action that we need.
Or maybe we will at least bear witness to the extinction of our current way of life with some joy.
Well, there's that too.
Well, I'm going to let that hang. Bill McKibben is author, educator, environmentalist, co-founder of 350.org. Bill, thanks to you and thanks to the Middlebury College studio for providing some space for you today to talk with us. I appreciate your time.
A pleasure as always, Jane. Thank you for your good work.
And Joshua Faulkner is program coordinator of the Farming and Climate Change Program at UVM Extension. Joshua, thanks to you for giving us just the slightest bit about what you're working on as well.
Thank you, Jane. Good to join you.
So as I mentioned earlier in the show, this is a lot of topics wrapped into one show, and each one could be its own discussion, its own topic. That question of should I stop eating meat, for example, is one that comes up in a question about agriculture. We'd love to know what shows you want to hear, what do you want to discuss, and what do you want to know stemming from this IPCC report. Send an email to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and let us know.